Globalization has gone too far. The West is practicing policies which are going to do away with Western civilization. We're taking people who don't have an understanding of British history, having no intention of integrating. There's not even an intention. And then we've wrapped up this mass migration in a cloak of protection with DEI, progressive discrimination, celebrating their cultures, setting our culture aside. There will be inter-ethnic violence. We will see increasing draconian policing.
Far-right thuggery.
We will see less freedom of speech. And we will lose our democracy, and we will lose our rights as human beings. Maybe this is a Dunkirk without a happy ending. But I'm going to die on the beaches fighting for a happy ending.
Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Johnny Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today, and that is Mr. Ben Habib, who is the former deputy leader of the Reform Party between 2023 and 2024, and a sometime Reform Party member of the European, or Brexit Party, member of the European Parliament. Ben, hello.
Hello, Ed.
Pleasure to meet you, and thank you for having me as your salubrious office. So can I start off by asking you, I want to go on to other things, but reform first. How did you first decide to get involved really in sort of conservative politics? What drew you into that?
Sort of pre-life. Yeah. So, I mean, I was never politically active until 2019. I was politically engaged all my life, but not active. I was focusing on bringing up a family, running my business like any normal individual would. And I suppose my first inclination, frankly, that our political class were selling us down the drain was in 2016 when I heard Mark Carney and George Osborne making all sorts of predictions about how the country would entirely collapse if we simply voted to leave the European Union. And that didn't make any sense to me at all. Mark Carney was on the record saying that he was putting aside £250 billion in case those were run on the banks on the 23rd of June. You may remember that, Ed. And I knew that to be utter garbage because a simple vote to leave meant nothing other than a declaration by the British people that they were going to leave in due course. And I wrote furious letters to the Telegraph and the FT at the time, some of which were printed. And that was my first sort of brush with politics. And then I receded back into the background after Theresa May became Prime Minister and said she would, Brexit means Brexit. No deal is better than a bad deal. Nothing's agreed till everything's agreed. All that kind of rhetoric. And I thought, great, she gets it. And I went back to running my own life again. And then things started getting wobbly towards the end of 2017, beginning of 2018. The Chequers deal was sort of being slowly revealed. And I remember getting concerned about what was going on. And a friend of mine who was a treasurer in the Conservative Party said, look, you should join as a donor and you get to meet cabinet ministers and you can find out precisely what's going on. So I joined in a modest way, one of their groups thing. That's called the Renaissance Group, to which you need to contribute a few thousand pounds a year. But that gives you the opportunity to have lunch with a cabinet minister once a month, 10 of you with a cabinet minister, you get to asking questions. And the first cabinet minister I met was Michael Gove. And I sat at lunch and I asked him what his plan was if we didn't get a good deal with the European Union. And he said, there is no plan B. We don't need a plan B because we will get a good deal. And at that point, the balloon went up for me. And I just saw, well, these people just simply are not thinking straight. And I became progressively more concerned. I've been on a journey of discovery, frankly, since 2018 on how badly run this country is. And the Michael Gove meeting in 2018 was a real heads up. And then, you know, we all saw how Theresa May didn't mean any of the things she had said about Brexit. And on the 29th of March, 2019, when she should have left, she didn't. She was then applying for extensions. Nigel Farage was setting up then the Brexit Party. And I was actually sitting in this room with our PR consultant, who is an old hack, and he knew Nigel Farage. And he said, well, Nigel Farage is sitting out. And I was, you know, mouthing off about how awful Theresa May was. And he said, do you want to meet Nigel Farage? And I said, well, you know, I don't know. I said, well, perhaps, okay, go on then. And I met Nigel Farage, and then I sort of haven't been able to extricate myself from the political landscape since.
You were elected a Brexit Party MEP in 2019 for a year, and then you were deputy leader of Reform.
Yeah,
don't want to dwell on this too much. But what was it then that went wrong?
Well, Reform is simply the Brexit Party rebranded. It's the same legal entity, and my first brush with Nigel Farage, in my view, not being entirely solid, was when he stood down 317 candidates unilaterally without discussion in November, 11th of November, ominous day on which to do it, 11th of November 2019 in the general election, and gave Boris Johnson that 80-seat majority, delivering to this country a withdrawal agreement that we all knew was awful. And the argument that Farage made was that it would be too dangerous not to give Boris Johnson the victory that we gave him, because there was a risk of a Corbyn government, second referendum, Brexit would be entirely reversed. And I accept that argument, but I wasn't happy by the unilateral way and the decision was made. But then I was very unhappy by Farage claiming, after we left the institutions of the EU on the 31st of January 2020, that Brexit was done. Brexit has not been done. Brexit was a constitutional matter. It wasn't an economic matter. There was no commitment by the British people to sign a new deal with the EU. It was a fundamental constitutional vote to take back control from Brussels to the United Kingdom, and for the entire United Kingdom to be governed by itself. And we didn't do that. We left Northern Ireland behind. We signed two new treaties, which commit us to complying with and aligning with the EU on state aid, competition, employment, and environmental law. We can't deviate from net zero without breaching our treaty with the EU. That same treaty, the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, committed us to staying in the European Convention of Human Rights. People don't know this. When I say this, they say, well, the ECHR's got nothing to do with the EU. And they're absolutely right. But in the agreement that Boris Johnson signed, we've committed to staying in the ECHR. The EU isn't even a member of the ECHR, and we've committed to the European arrest warrant.
Well, we committed to something that seems to be the cause of a great deal of our immigration problem.
Absolutely. The withdrawal agreement and the trade and cooperation agreement, which followed it a year later, are absolutely abhorrent agreements. Absolutely abhorrent. And it's critical. It was critical, in my view, that Farage stand his ground, not vacate the political battlefield, so that Boris Johnson and others could be held to account, to force them into delivering what they promised they would deliver. But actually, Farage vacated the play field, the political battle field.
Does seem to do that again and again, though. He seems to get to a point of sort of victory or something.
Yeah.
And then say, I want my life back. I don't understand that.
Yeah. It is something I don't want to. I've had a go at Farage publicly a lot, and I don't want to overdo it. But it is a great weakness in Farage that he didn't stay, and it's a great tragedy he didn't stay on the political battlefield in 2016 after we won the referendum, because that was the moment Brexiteers needed to paint their vision of a post-EU existence for the United Kingdom. It was a great moment to come out with a whole set of policies on what Theresa May should have been doing, but instead there was a complete vacuum from those people who'd campaigned to leave the EU. And then again, there was a complete vacuum after Boris Johnson was elected Prime Minister. And we all knew Boris Johnson wasn't going to do the right. We all knew it. There'd be multiple clips said if you go back to 2019, people like Farage, myself and others, saying the withdrawal agreement's an abomination. And we all knew it was going to be bad. But anyway, he vacated the battlefield. And when I pleaded with him to stay all about it, I said I didn't want this to be a Farage bashing exercise. But when I pleaded with him at dinner with Rupert Lowe and I took him out for dinner with another guy called Robert Rowland, who sadly since died. And I pleaded with Nigel Farage in August 2020 to hold Boris Johnson's feet to the fire because the trade and cooperation agreement hadn't been finalized. I could see Johnson was slipping. We need you, Nigel, to come back and, you know, campaign. He said, well, it's all well and good for you, Ben. You were born with a silver spoon rammed up your backside, or words to that effect.
Shows you went to private school.
And you know, I want to go and make money. Fair enough. And so when Richard Tice approached me in November 2022, I think was the first time he asked me to join Reform, I was quite reluctant to join because Farage was the majority owner. And as majority owner in the shares, he could just stop anyone from doing what they wished to do if he so decided. And I was pushing Farage to give up his ownership of Reform even before I joined Reform. And he declined. And then I asked Richard Tice to write a letter co-signed by him and Farage saying that the party would be run in a consensual manner, that we would fight for Brexit. We would fight to reunite Northern Ireland with Great Britain, which, as you know, has been left behind as a result of the withdrawal agreement. And that we would do no deals with the Tories. And Farage refused to sign that letter. And under pressure from others who were joining at the same time, and Widdecombe in particular, and obviously Richard Tice. Under pressure, I accepted joining on the strength of Richard Tice alone signing that letter, because he was the leader of the party at the time. And I made the calculation, and it was the wrong calculation, that Farage wouldn't come back because he was keen on, you know, going off and making money, etc. And frankly, the minute Farage came back on the 3rd of June, a decision he made again unilaterally without consulting me or even forewarning me as deputy leader that he was coming back. When he came back on the 3rd of June, I knew that it was urgent then for Reform to democratize. And I fought a campaign of which you might be aware, Ed, for the democratization of the party. But I also knew probably that my time with Reform was up because Farage is a maverick, and this country can't deal with any more maverick behavior. What this country needs is someone leading it, leading a team of very capable people who have joined up political, philosophical framework, which puts the United Kingdom firmly at the center of all policy making and will not deviate from it. And I've got my very serious doubts that Reform UK is able to do that.
Reform are on the crest of a wave. They've done extremely well in the local elections for various reasons. They've got all these councillors. They've had an MP elected in a by-election who's sworn in yesterday or whatever it was. What do you think is going to happen? Is this going to carry on, or are there certain intrinsic problems with the movement or with the leadership that are going to mean that this won't carry on?
Well, I was utterly delighted. Paradoxically, it might seem to you, but I was utterly delighted by Reform's performance in the local elections, because even though I'd advocated people not vote for them, because frankly, I couldn't advocate for people to vote for Farage, knowing what I know about him, but I was delighted that actually they did so well, because it evidenced that that majority that had delivered the vote to leave the EU, the same people who delivered us to the European Parliament in 2019, and then gave Boris Johnson the majority he got in December 2019, that segment of the British electorate were still out there wanting a proud, resurgent, independent, prosperous United Kingdom. They're still voting for it. And so I was really pleased to see that, because I thought maybe they were so despondent, like they were in the general election last year. You know, the Labour Party won their thumping landslide with fewer votes in 2024 than they got in 2019. And I thought the electorate had maybe gone back into their shells and thought, well, we've had enough of the political class. But there's still the ability to galvanise the electorate. And the other thing that I take great encouragement from is that the electorate, in significant part, voted Reform because of how bad the Labour Party and Conservatives are, not necessarily because how much they love Reform. And what's critical to me, frankly, what's the only thing that matters to me is that the United Kingdom is rescued from the precipice on which it now stands, off which it may have already fallen, but it needs to be lassoed and saved and restored back to, a safe place. And if the electorate is still there prepared to vote for that kind of result, then, you know, I think that it's possible to deliver it. I think that, this new party that
leaked that I'm, you know, setting up, I think that could be quite instrumental in making sure that we do deliver the United Kingdom to a place of safety.
Bluntly, the thing that from other people I talked about Farage about, I'll move on from Farage after this, but the thing I want is what I would foresee from what I know of the past is that this is all going to go great for a while and then he's going to start falling out with people. And this is what Godfrey Bloom was saying to me. It was what Gerald Batten was saying to me. There'll be dissent within the ranks. Yeah. And this won't last. Do you think that's probable?
There's certainly huge precedent for it, including myself and Rupert Lowe. I mean, I think what Farage and co. tried to do to Rupert Lowe is abhorrent. I don't know if you're familiar with it, Ed, but they obviously fell out, in my view, significantly because Elon Musk endorsed Rupert Lowe and said Farage wasn't fit to lead reform. And I think that would have really bruised Farage's very thin-skinned ego. And when they decided to part with Rupert Lowe, instead of just parting with him, they sought to not just destroy his reputation, but frankly, to try and get him incarcerated. You know, the complaint made to the police by Zia Yusuf, if it's upheld, I think it's completely vexatious and frivolous claim that complaint that he's made. But if it is by some miracle upheld against Rupert,
what complaint is this?
So the complaint that Zia Yusuf made to the police in March this year was that in December, Rupert Lowe had verbally threatened him with violence in a way that he obviously took to be serious and therefore has reported Rupert Lowe under, I think, the Public Orders Act, paragraph 4 of the Public Orders Act, which I think, I'm going by memory, has a maximum jail sentence associated with it of 7 years. Now, you know, if Rupert Lowe, 67-year-old law-abiding guy who's did fantastically well for the party, one of the best parliamentarians, raised more questions, written questions than any other parliamentarian, has absolutely represented his constituents in a brilliant way. You know, if Rupert Lowe had made such a verbal threat in December, why the hell did Zia Yusuf wait until the first week of March to make the complaint? And why was that complaint made the minute that they decided to throw Rupert Lowe out of the party? The coincidence is too massive not to actually reveal, as I say, that the complaint is vexatious. It's got no substance to it. And the next question then, naturally, one should ask is, if Zia Yusuf made this complaint, why hasn't he been thrown out? If it's a vexatious complaint, as I believe it to be, why hasn't he been thrown out of Reform UK? Why hasn't Farage chucked Zia Yusuf out? And if they won't act with principle when it comes to something as fundamental as someone's freedom, which is what they've tried to yank away from Rupert Lowe, then they can't be trusted in office. They simply cannot be trusted in office.
So what are your... So you've left the party and you were telling me a while ago when we were emailing about plans with perhaps with Rupert Lowe to set up something else. So what is it that you're setting up?
So I've taken control of... I hadn't expected this to break, but someone was obviously searching Company's house and came across what I was up to. I've taken control of a shell company, a company limited by guarantee, which is the appropriate form of structure for a political party, a non-profit entity. A company limited by guarantee, which has a bank account, believe it or not, and it was the bank account that I was interested in, because getting a bank account nowadays for a political organisation is very difficult. So this was a clean shell, just recently set up with a bank account, and so it's a vehicle to create what I hope will be a fantastic party, taking a sort of Trumpian description. It'll be a really beautiful party. It'll be the best political constitution. I can't do the voice. But it'll be the best political party in the world in its construct. Its constitution will be absolutely first class and unfalterable. And it will have the ability, I hope, to go well beyond my own lifetime and you know, my children's lifetime, and represent truly British interests. And that's what I want. I just want the ability for this country to be saved. And if I can set something up which is good enough to attract great people into it, hold great people in it, and is ideologically solid but democratic, then I think I would have done, frankly, my job in politics.
Yes, and this will be, is Rupert involved in this?
He may or may not. I don't want to give any names away, but there will be lots of people involved in it, of you know, whom you'll know.
Okay, what would you say to those that would have heard that this is kind of the worst time to do something like this because of how well reform have just done?
This is the best time to do something like this. You know, I had to answer all these questions, similar questions, when I was deputy leader of reform with respect to the Conservative Party. You know, you're splitting the vote, you're going to make it difficult for a so-called right-wing government. This isn't about right-wing or left-wing or splitting votes. This is about an agenda which delivers the United Kingdom to safety. It's not left, it's not right. The whole notion of left and right is wrong. And Farage, frankly, in my view, clearly, hasn't got what it takes. And the Conservative Party clearly hasn't got what it takes. I mean, they're absolutely silent at the moment. I don't know what the Conservative Party's doing. It's almost as if they want to commit willful harakiri. Farage is helping them on their way. So I absolutely think a new political force is needed. And maybe, in the creation of this political force, Farage will do the right thing, democratise his party, bring on great people for fear of what I'm doing. He may actually do the right thing with reform, in which case I can retreat and it's job done.
Yeah.
But he's not going to do it the way he's doing it. He's not going to deliver this country to safety the way he's going about it at the moment.
Okay, Ben, question. I mean, you seem to me passionate about Britain, about the future of Britain, yeah, about sorting it out. You know, it's your country and you want the best for it. You've even got a Union Jack in your office.
Yeah.
Now, of course, you were born in Sindh.
Yeah, Karachi.
And in Karachi. And as I understand it, you didn't come to this country until you were sort of 9 or 10 or something.
13.
13, okay, so even later, 13. And then you went to school here and university here and so on. Recently, there's been a lot of talk, particularly on Twitter, but it's been put in the newspapers via Sueli Braverman, who has said, well, she's British maybe, but she's certainly not English.
Yeah.
And there's been, this has set off, and I don't know if it's a backlash against all of the racist that gets thrown at us over the last 30 or 40 yeah, years, of what it is to be British. And you've got a lot of people online that are just arguing that no, a person from, certainly even a person that is born in this country, who is Punjabi or whatever, is not British, and not English, and but you espouse or have talked about things like deportation, mass deportation, and this
of illegal,
of illegal immigrants. But it opens up a question where quite
so
influential
explain.
People yeah, are, yeah, are saying online, sort of, you know, influencers, well, look, just deport, you know, these people are foreign, these people aren't English, they're not part of our genetic family. We're all descended from Edward III, you know, we are, it's a statistical fact.
Yeah.
The two average English people are 12th cousins,
yeah,
and these people, and we've brought these foreigners in, and it's caused a lot of problems, rape gangs in Northern England, conflict, ethnic conflict, and just end it. I mean, what do you think about that?
So I'm not an ethno-nationalist.
No.
Obviously, that would be turkeys and Christmas. But I am different, I think. Suella Braverman, by the way, I've got a huge regard for Suella Braverman. She may not have been the best Home Secretary, and a lot went wrong under her time in that office, but her hands were tied by Rishi Sunak. But she's absolutely solid, and she says things, brave things, which people in her position are not prepared to say. And just saying them in itself is worthy. But I'm slightly different in my ethnic makeup to Suella Braverman, because even though my father is a Pakistani Punjabi, my mother is English, blonde, blue-eyed, born in Isleworth. I have a maternal grandfather who fought in World War I and was part of the Home Guard in World War II. And, you know, and I was brought up on a diet of Englishness, Britishness, even in Karachi. I was born in immediate post-imperial India, if you like. It was Pakistan, but the tailwinds of British imperialism was still blowing through the subcontinent at that time. And there was a very, I mean, for example, the generals that ran Pakistan had all been trained at Sandhurst. Many of my parents' friends were English people in Karachi who were born in the 19th century. Can you believe it? People I knew as a child were born in the 19th century.
Born in the early 60s or something.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so I was imbued with a sense of what the British Empire was, what British imperialism meant for the subcontinent, what the United Kingdom was. You know, I was brought up on a diet of British culture. And then, of course, I came to England. I was educated at something called the Karachi Grammar School, which is a school set up by the British when they were in Karachi. And then I came to rugby school, you know, in the Midlands, which is about as English as you can get.
It's the essence of the public school.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. It, in fact, defines public school.
It defines it. Yeah. It's a school that is like rugby. That was how it was.
Yeah, exactly. It was Thomas Arnold.
Thomas Arnold, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, I've got lots of Pakistani friends, and I loved my childhood in Pakistan. It was an idyllic time as a child. It was a fantastic childhood I had. But I am British through and through, and I happen to be English as well.
You're half English. I suppose you'd what they call in India an Anglo-Indian.
I'm an Anglo-Indian, or whatever I am. But my heart and soul is British, and I can't make any case for the damage that we are doing to our country on the altar of liberalism or globalism, the preparedness of our political class, for example, to throw Northern Ireland under a bus when the Northern Irish have been so steadfast in their support of the United Kingdom. And I, unlike so many people, I think we've been actually a damn good force for good, you know, throughout history, frankly. I mean, I think I look back at our history and I think, oh, we may not be the greatest country on the planet right now. We're the best bloody country on the planet. We've always been the best country on the planet.
Were you raised Muslim or Christian?
Ambiguous. But my mother is a practicing Christian, very Christian. So we went to church, you know, on Easter and Christmas Day, and we celebrated Christmas and Easter and everything.
So that's very interesting then, because I think that you have
I'm baptised, by the way.
Okay, yeah. It's baptised Christian. Yeah. So you have a very interesting outsider perspective then to the politics, because you have, in a sense, one foot in Pakistan, or genetically anyway, and anyway, you've lived there, for God's sake, at a formative time, and one foot here. And that's actually not infrequent, chaps, if you look into the history of things. There's people like the guy that's in charge of El Salvador, similar thing. Lebanese, El Salvadorian. So what lessons, living in Pakistan, have you learnt about what it is that... It's in some ways, I wouldn't call it a failed state, but there's a lot of problems there.
Well, can I just say, when I was born and my time in Pakistan, by the time I left, Pakistan was deteriorating. But at the time that I was born, Pakistan was a much wealthier country per capita than India. It had much greater potential and promise. It was a much stronger ally of the United States of America and the United Kingdom. My peer group in Pakistan looked very fondly at their British imperial past. There was no animosity from my peer group towards what had gone on, you know, before 1947 when Pakistan was created. None. No animosity. And people looked to the United Kingdom and to the United States with aspiration and hope a sense of allegiance, maybe too strong, but, you know, they're absolute allies. Things have changed since then. Islam has morphed since then quite dramatically. Islam has become quite a fundamentalist Wahhabi, if you know what I mean, form of religion.
It's the Muslim Brotherhood.
It's the Muslim Brotherhood.
I think Qutb.
And there was an exportation of this through the early 80s and onwards and to now. And there's been a revision of history that's taken place alongside it, including in Pakistan, where now they don't, I think, you know, people who are younger than me in Pakistan don't look back and celebrate their British roots. They don't, because they've been told not to. And of course it's the same over here, Ed, of which I'm sure you're very familiar. Mm-hmm. And there's been a revision going on of history, and it's been put in place, aided and abetted, by a series of British governments, frankly, who seem to me not to be proud of this country, starting with Blair. You know, he may have been New Labour, but the things that he did were deeply damaging to the United Kingdom.
I concur, but I'd be interested in your perspective as a person, as I say, with an immigrant background. He brought in a series of laws that, in a sense, helped to make British people almost second-class citizens, or almost an aristocratization of foreigners. If you go back centuries and centuries to the 16th century in this country, then people that were the gentry had extra rights. They could duel where ordinary people couldn't. They could wear certain kinds of furs where ordinary people couldn't. There was even laws against sort of cheeking members of the nobility. They had to be addressed in their proper titles. They have. If you bring in, it's racially motivated, then suddenly you have almost a separate class that you've got to be careful what you say to him. Insult him, but don't insult him in that way. And I think that was
quite
dangerous.
The most, he's done a lot of damaging things, but I think the most damaging thing, undoubtedly, in my mind, it was the Human Rights Act, codifying, basically writing a constitution in one act for the United Kingdom. And in that one act, he basically set aside the importance of being a British citizen. And it ceased to be a privilege and a beneficial and sort of beneficial position to have as a British citizen. And through the Human Rights Act, he equated all humanity in the United Kingdom as being equal, and set aside began the process of the setting aside of what it means to be British. And so now, when you have a debate with someone about what does it mean to be British, you're reduced to banal things like, well, being nice and, you know, allowing people to have a right to family, and you start quoting the Human Rights Act. Whereas actually what it means to be British is to feel a swelling of pride when the word Nelson is, when the name Nelson is mentioned, or when William Pitt's mentioned, or Winston Churchill. There's got to be a feeling, there's got to be something rumbling in your stomach at that point. If it isn't, if you don't have your heart behind all of that, you're not really with it.
But isn't that the case? I mean, even with you, you say you're not an ethno-nationalist, but I'm trying to think, what's that? There's a group in Pakistan, and a lot of them practically look European. What's it, not Pashtun?
Pathans.
So it strikes me that you could be probably mistaken for, the surname's Habib, people might think Pathan. They might wonder why the Christian name is Ben, but they might think that.
Well, my name is Benjamin. My parents were quite clever, so my mum's English, as I mentioned, Jennifer Catherine Hodgson, as her name was. And so we were all named names that could work in Pakistan and work in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, but what do you think about the idea that part of why you feel that pride, part of why it stirs your heart, is because you are half English, and by half English, I mean you are a person who is related, genetically related, to the English ancestors, to the English ethne, to the English genetic extended family, and that is why it stirs something in you.
Well, I mean...
Are you ready for the future of the West?